The following program is produced and paid for by Temple Emmanuel.
What?
I know how we can run everybody out of Rock Reach.
How?
We'll kill the firstborn male child in every household.
Too Jewish.
Shalom, and welcome to the Too Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Rabbi Gil Marks, author of James Beard Award-winning cookbooks and an expert on Jewish cuisine today and throughout history. We'll also have visits from our two Jewish experts on the international scene, Tom Price, and our maven on Israel, Guy Gelbert. Please email your comments to us at TooJewishRadio@yahoo.com or visit us on the web at TooJewishRadio.com. Too Jewish is sponsored this morning by Temple Emmanuel, a Reformed Jewish community for all of Tucson. Call 327-4501 for information on Arizona's finest synagogue, the only full-service Reformed congregation in southern Arizona. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Too Jewish.
Shalom. I had a strange and interesting experience recently that I must share with you today. I'm a congregational rabbi by profession, senior rabbi at Temple Emmanuel in Tucson, Arizona, where I've been for nearly 12 years. Our congregation, however, has been here for over 100 years, longer than Arizona has been a state, by the way, process which we began celebrating last week, commencing the Arizona centennial year. Anyway, since our temple has been a fixture of this community for so long, and because we have had a pretty good Jewish library for many decades, we're often the recipient of stray boxes of people's old Jewish books. This is how it works. An elderly relative dies, a bubby or zadie, father or mother, or great uncle or aunt, and the family closes up the home and has to get rid of the leftover possessions. And soon, a box appears in our front office. These boxes are filled with random assortments of Jewish books collected over the past 70 years or so. Hebrew prayer books issued by the U.S. military in World War II, Yiddish books brought from the old country or printed on the Lower East Side, coffee table books about Israel from the 60s or 70s, lots of Chaim Potok or Leon Uris novels, English-Hebrew dictionaries from the 1950s, guidebooks to the Middle East from 1982, and, you know, so on. I always go through the boxes to see if there are any treasures to be found. Once in a great while, there's a rare book, or a well-bound classic, or a lesser work from a great author, or even an unusual sacred text, a sefer. Typically, there isn't much we don't already have in our collection, or that isn't simply hopelessly out of date. But sometimes there's an unusual book, or a real treasure, or something else. On more than a few occasions, I have found copies of one of my grandfather, Rabbi Samuel S. Kohan, or my great-uncle, Rabbi Beryl D. Kohan's books on Jewish ideas and concepts. I always feel as though I am reclaiming them when I add them to my collection. Well, a month ago or so, one of these boxes of books showed up in our office unannounced and unanticipated. Most of the contents weren't interesting, to be honest, books we have or that aren't really of use. I was about to turn the box over to be redonated when a title caught my eye. Krynki en Ruinas, the title read, in what looked like it might be Polish, perhaps, a language I don't know. It had the publication date in red letters on it, though, 1948. I paused and then stopped. Krynki was another name, the Polish or maybe Russian name I remembered, for the shtetl, the little town in Eastern Europe where my mother's parents were born and grew up before they immigrated to America from Krynek. I turned the book over to see if I could confirm its relationship to my family. Krynek in Churban, it read in Yiddish, a language I can read and kind of understand. That translates to Krynek destroyed, in English, the language I actually speak, and I realized immediately that what I had in my hands was a Zecherbuch, a remembrance book published by the survivors and overseas families of the victims of the Nazi Holocaust from my grandparents' hometown. I was a bit shocked. What was this book doing here in Tucson, Arizona, 60 years and half a world away from the ruined remains of the shtetl I'd heard my Bubby and Zadie speak about over 35 years ago? Of course, it meant that someone who had died here in Tucson recently must have had family in Krynek. in the odd polyglot country called Russia-Poland, sometimes controlled by Russia, sometimes Poland, which ultimately had its Jewish population brutally annihilated by the Nazis. I looked through the book, filled with the names and stories of the people of my grandparents' town, and, of course, especially the story of their martyrdom at the hands of the Wehrmacht and the SS. It was an interesting and then horrifying tale, fully familiar because of long knowledge of the Holocaust, but chilling nonetheless. And yet, it was strange and eerie to read of places my grandparents had once mentioned, to see the faces of people they may have remembered from their youth before they immigrated to America. I now know who passed away and owned that book, but I was unaware that he had come from my own family's birthplace, and that made him a kind of landsman to them. He died last summer in his late 90s. He would have been a little younger than my grandparents, perhaps 10 years, but surely he would have known some of the same people, experienced many of the same things they did in the same place. I'm sorry that I didn't know that this man, a member of my own temple for many years, had come originally from my grandparents' small shtetl. You know, perhaps there really are no coincidences. But I am grateful for the chance to remember Krinnick and the Sturmach and Lieberman families and all their relations and all that vibrant, impoverished, committed Jewish life. May their memory be a blessing. In a much lighter vein this morning, there was a great insert in the newspaper this week here in Tucson honoring the many characters who helped shape this rough-and-tumble Western territory into a state some 99 years ago. Many of them, cowboys, peddlers, merchants, and ranchers, were Jewish. And they were no less colorful than any of the other legends of our state's past, like, you know, Wyatt Earp. And so, in honor of all those Jewish cowboys and characters, here's a less than perfectly accurate musical version of another one of those legendary Jewish characters of the Old West. Long before saddles blazed across the West, there was the Ballad of Irving.
He was short and fat and rode out of the West with a Mogan David on his silver vest. He was mean and nasty right clear through, which was kind of weird because he was yellow too. They called him Irving. Big Irving. Big Short Irving. Big Short Fat Irving. The 142nd fastest gun in the West. He came from the old bar mitzvah spread, schlepping a salami and pumpernickel bread. He always followed his mother's wishes. Even on the range, he used two sets of dishes. Irving. Big Fat Irving. Big Sissy Irving. The 142nd fastest gun in the West. Irving. 141 could draw faster than he, but Irving was looking for 143, walked in a salt saloon like a man insane, and ordered three fingers of 2 cents plain. Irving. Big Fat Irving. Big Sport Irving. The 142nd fastest gun in the West. The James boys was coming on a train at first sun, and the town said, Irving, we need your gun. Well, that train pulled in at the break of dawn. Irving's gun was there, but Irving was gone. Irving. Big Fat Irving. Big Help Irving. The 142nd fastest gun in the West. Well, finally, Irving got 3 slugs in the belly. It was right outside the Frontier Deli. He was sitting there twirling his gun around, and Butterfingers Irving gunned himself down. Irving. Big Fat Irving. Big Dum Dum Irving. Big Dum Dum Dead Irving. The 142nd fastest gun in the West.
Really?
That was the classic Ballad of Irving, all about being Jewish in the Wild West for Rodeo Weekend coming up here in Tucson. Well, it's sort of about that. Anyway, when we return in a few moments on Too Jewish, we'll meet our guest, Rabbi Gil Marks, a remarkable combination of rabbi, James Beard Award-winning cookbook author, historian, social worker, and Jewish food expert. Find out what food can teach us about our history and about being Jewish when we come back on Too Jewish.
Safety. It's a word we take for granted at home and at the workplace, but sometimes safety isn't a sure thing. Environmental Strategies, Inc. is an environmental remediation company that's been promoting safe living in Arizona since 1989. Environmental Strategies specializes in asbestos and lead abatement, mold remediation, and industrial cleaning. In addition, they have a building and remodeling division that makes it convenient for clients to get all their services from one contractor. Environmental Strategies jobs range from seam tape removal in a single-family home to insulation removal in a Challenger Learjet aircraft and everything in between. So, if you're in need of asbestos or lead removal, mold remediation, industrial cleaning, or top-notch general contracting services, call Environmental Strategies today at 884-1114. Estimates and bids are free and confidential. Ken Goodman is the president, and he'd love to talk with you about your project. Environmental Strategies, serving all of Arizona since 1989. Call 884-1114.
Hi, Joe Spina, Mama's Pizza. Sometimes I think my brother Vinny and I are the luckiest guys in the whole wide world. You see, to us, Mama's is more than just a restaurant. It's a connection to our past. Back in New York, food was the center of our lives. Our family got together for almost any reason to enjoy the great Italian dishes our mom used to make. The scent of slow-cooking marinara. The distinct aroma of garlic simmering in olive oil. Pasta boiling on the stove. These are memories that remind me of family, friends, home. Our goal at Mama's is to serve more than just delicious Italian food. Sure, our pizza and calzones are outstanding. Our cheesecake is to die for. But we strive to serve you more. Call it atmosphere or mood. Or you can just call it love. We hope the next time you come into one of Mama's four locations, it'll become one of your pleasant memories. To Vinny and me, that's the measure of our success. Now repeat after me. Mama's Pizza.
We're delighted to welcome the two Jewish Rabbi Gil Marks, a kind of, I don't know, Jewish Renaissance man, author, rabbi, historian, chef, social worker, a leading authority on culinary subjects in general and Jewish and kosher cuisine in particular. Among his published books are the Encyclopedia of Jewish Food, the James Beard Award-winning Olive Trees and Honey, a treasury of vegetarian recipes from Jewish communities around the world, and the James Beard Award finalist, The World of Jewish Cooking, as well as other books. He was included in Jewish Forward's annual Forward 50 list of the most influential Jewish Americans in 2010. How did your mother feel about that?
Oh, Chef Nakas.
Absolutely. You're a self-taught chef, and yet you became a gourmet cook. That's not an automatic thing. Tell us a little bit about that process.
Well, speaking of my mother, she claims all the credit for my career, telling people that when I was younger, I would complain about her food all the time, and she would say, well, if you don't like what I make, make your own, and I did.
And still doing it, I see.
And still doing it. Like when I used to run a guidance department in a high school, you teach the kids study skills and stuff. One of the things, once you overcome the initial fear of the unknown and have a few basic skills, then you can build on that and do anything. And that's the same with cooking. And I would have friends over for meals and try to do different things. And out, they'd ooh and ah, and I'd get my ego stroking for the week. And each time I tried out doing myself and developed this reputation. And I didn't necessarily plan on it, but fortunately it took me to a very interesting path in life.
So, if somebody called you the kosher Jeffrey Steingarten, would that be a compliment, or?
I wouldn't be upset, but not necessarily. I do actually prepare the foods and stuff, and I'm a humbly a good cook, but it's primarily, I think, as a food historian, where I try to stress in my books, so all of them, whether the Encyclopedia of Jewish Food or Olive Trees and Honey, it's a narrative of the Jewish people. It tells the story of the Jewish people for the past 2,000 years, because food carries culture. And food carries history, and to know any society, any community's history, you really need to know their food, and Jews in particular, since we're so obsessed with food.
We will talk much more about that. You have a great piece on carob on your website and your blog, and you somehow make every part of food interesting and connected to Jewish history. But of course, as you noted, since we're obsessed with it, maybe that's a natural transition. We will talk much more with Rabbi Gil Marks a little bit when we come back on Too Jewish.
If your parents or other loved ones are in need of assisted living, consider making the choice that Dorothy Daniels' family made, Handmaker.
Living at Handmaker does make me feel very independent, like I was still in my house. The best part of it is I don't have to clean it.
Assisted living at Handmaker promotes an active and independent life. All needs are met, including weekly housekeeping and linen service, transportation to doctor's appointments, restaurants, banks, and shopping. And living at Handmaker is fun.
Every 2 weeks, there is a man who comes with a saxophone, and we dance, and I love that because I love to dance.
Handmaker is centrally located on Rosemont, just south of Grant, and includes 1 and 2 bedroom suites and cozy studios with patios and balconies.
I would recommend Handmaker to anyone because I feel very safe and secure here. The people that work here are very nice, considerate, and that means a lot.
For a tour and consultation, call 322-7035 or visit their website at handmaker.org.
Tucson Hebrew Academy is an independent school for children from kindergarten through 8th grade. It has a long-standing record of academic excellence and an unparalleled integrated general and Judaic studies curriculum. With a variety of music and fine arts classes combined with the award-winning sports programs, THA nourishes the students in body, mind, and spirit. The atmosphere in our classrooms encourages self-assured self-expression, critical thinking, and respect for diversity. THA's low student-teacher ratio allows its highly qualified faculty to provide instruction based on the most up-to-date research methods in science, technology, math, and literature. THA students understand the relevance of Jewish values in the modern world. THA sees learning as a way of life and builds a strong sense of community. They're enrolling now. Please give your child the gift of a THA education. For more information on how to enroll your child or to schedule a tour, call 529-3888. That's 529-3888. Or visit thaaz.org. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at twojewishradio@yahoo.com or call 520-327-4501 or visit our website at twojewishradio.com. You can get CDs of past and present shows through the website or downloading us from there or from the Apple iTunes Store as podcasts you can subscribe to. Do you remember back when we had a holiday in this country called Washington's Birthday? I was thinking about it this week with all the President's Day sales in the newspaper. In America, in the 21st century's second decade, we move our holidays wherever they can do the most commercial and recreational good. That means that the two separate festivals of my youth, Lincoln's and Washington's birthdays, loved it. 2 weeks in February with 4 days of school and no more. Well, they've been eliminated. Which is a shame, because both Lincoln and Washington were exceptional men and fabulous American heroes and leaders. I'm currently finishing Ron Chernow's magisterial and fascinating biography of George Washington. It was Washington's extraordinary dedication to religious pluralism and personal freedom of conscience that meant so much to the Jews of America and to the world. I'm going to quote from Washington's famous letter to the Jews of Newport, Rhode Island. In 1790, they sent the president, then the new president, congratulatory greetings and received back from him the following note. The citizens of the United States of America have a right to applaud themselves for giving to mankind examples of an enlarged and liberal policy, a policy worthy of imitation. All possess alike liberty of conscience and immunities of citizenship. It is now no more that toleration is spoken of, as if it were by the indulgence of one class of people that another enjoyed the exercise of their inherent natural rights. For happily, the government of the United States, which gives to bigotry no sanction, to persecution no assistance, requires only that they who live under its protection should demean themselves as good citizens. Washington's exceptional reply has served our people so well, as it has every religious minority throughout our country's history. Whether or not Washington's birthday still gets celebrated, the legacy of this extraordinary message and the acts that accompanied it have made America the greatest country for Jews in world history, with the sole exception of our own nation of Israel. And that legacy, along with all the rest that Washington accomplished, will live on forever. We welcome our maven on Israel, the Israel Center Director, Guy Gelbart. Boker Tov. Good morning, Guy.
Boker Tov, Rabbi. How are you today?
I'm well. Big doings in the world. Mubarak fell. Egypt has dissolved its parliament. And suddenly we're going to see democracy all over the Middle East, besides Israel. Israel's already democratic. How realistic is this perspective?
Well, as you said, the window of change has been blowing through the Middle East. Where will this wind bring us at is a big question yet to be answered. While we do have some hope for democracy, we need to remember that building a democracy is not something that happens within a night. To have a real democracy requires having democratic institutes and the split of power. It also requires a certain education. You need people to understand what freedom of speech is. And we're talking about countries that haven't had freedom of speech ever. So that's a very big question and a challenging issue. Another aspect that we need to remember when we look at Egypt and other Arab countries is that most of these regimes don't really care today about their own people. And we see a lot of poverty and lack of education in wide ranges of society. Into this void, into this gap, a lot of fundamentalistic Islam movements, like the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt, are pushing themselves into this gap. They're building hospitals, they're doing social work, and they're building education systems. Through those education systems, they're spreading very extreme ideological ideas, and you end up seeing a 9-year-old boy telling you that his biggest ambition and dream in life is to be a suicide bomber. So that's a tricky question. Will the Middle East become more democratic, or will in 3 years we'll find ourselves with a very extreme Muslim fundamentalistic Middle East?
It's a frightening prospect. You know, I think about the fact that democracy really relies on an educated middle class whose values will end up being stability and consistency and freedom. And really, you can't describe any Arab country as having those characteristics right now.
This is true, and I want to point out that the danger here is not only to the Middle East, because those fundamentalistic movements are trying to reach out not only within the Middle East, they are reaching out to Muslim communities all across the world. And in a way, it's not a fight about land, it's a fight about values. Do we support the values of the West, of freedom of speech, of open-minded, of giving rights to minorities as well as to the majority, or do we support a darker vision? And that's the thing we need to think about.
It's a great set of questions. We will talk next week. Thanks, Guy.
Thank you.
When we come back, we'll hear from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, and get the old Jewish joke of the week. We visit weekly with the great restaurateur, Janos Wilder of Janos Restaurant in the J Bar. Good morning, Janos.
Good morning, Rabbi. Please forgive me.
Oh, well, you know, I'm in that business.
I've opened another restaurant.
Downtown?
Downtown Kitchen and Cocktails, 135 South 6. I got to tell you, I am so excited about it. We have created an absolutely gorgeous space where the former Barrio Grill was located. And the food, well, you know my food.
Your food is the best I've ever had. Don't tell my wife. although she agrees. So you're creating magic food, as she calls it, downtown. What's the best way for people to make reservations to try the new place?
Just give us a call at 623-7700 or go online at downtownkitchen.com. We're serving lunch Monday through Saturday, dinner 7 days a week, happy hour, late night Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, and all with prices so low, you can afford to eat here every day.
I would love to. Thanks, Janos.
Thank you, Rabbi.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
So there's a new movie you want to talk about.
Yeah, you know, once in a while we talk about movies of interest for their Jewish content or their implications for the Jewish world or whatever. And there's kind of an obscure movie made by British independent filmmakers at the Loft right now, or at least there was until very recently when this is actually aired, called Four Lions. And it's reviewed as being a spoof. It kind of masquerades as a Three Stooges movie. It's very funny. It's slapstick. It's about these idiot children of Pakistani immigrants, not immigrants themselves, who are kind of middle-class young men. One has a beautiful wife and child in a nice middle-class home. And they live in a particular neighborhood of London. I don't know, Fordham, Fulham, something. And they become suicide bombers, and two go off to Pakistan for training, and they're so incompetent that they get sent home. And you're laughing, kind of slapping your knee, a little bit uncomfortably. And right before you get to the end of the movie becomes deadly serious. And you realize that you have learned an enormous amount about why a successful middle-class person in a rich country like England would join a movement like this and eventually would blow himself up. And in the end, it's not funny at all, but you realize that by packaging it as a funny movie, the filmmakers, the screenwriter, whatever, everybody involved in producing this has avoided being preachy. They've avoided being too pedantic, but they've really helped you understand not what makes everybody a suicide bomber and not why every terrorist becomes a terrorist, but by one segment of this, how, why, by what criteria, one segment of the population that does become suicide bombers in Western Europe, whether their origins are in the Indian subcontinent or in the Arab world or whatever. In fact, one of these guys is purely English, only like masquerading as an Islamist. I mean, he's got, you know, blonde hair, blue eyes, and who knows what his religious background is. But sociologically and psychologically, this movie is a masterwork, and I encourage you and your listeners to see it.
That's Four Lions. You know, I just finishing an Israeli book called Almost Dead, a very interesting book by Asaf Gavron about both suicide bombers and their victims, told in this sort of odd, picaresque kind of style, and it draws you in. It's not the usual. Right. These are real human beings engaging in this.
Right.
It's weird, disturbing, and very interesting.
Right. Well, that's how this movie was.
Thanks,
plus,
Tom.
Plus, funny.
Funny is good. Thanks, Tom. We'll talk next week.
I look forward to it.
And now it's time for the old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor your Bubby and Zadie knew. Brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. One night, as Moshe is undressing for bed, before he puts on his pajamas, he takes a long and hard look at himself, naked in the full-length mirror. His wife Sarah comes into the bedroom, and Moshe says to her, "Darling, I'm looking so fat and ugly these days. I don't know how you can bear to be around me. I'm horrible. I've decided I must get in shape and lose weight. I'm going to start first thing tomorrow. But in the meantime, darling, do you think you could please boost my confidence by paying me a compliment?" "Well," Sarah replies, "you have perfect vision for a man of your age." That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well and lose weight. And now a word of Torah. This week's Torah portion of Vayakhel deals with the question of the creation of the tabernacle in the wilderness, the consecration of the first central worship sanctuary for the people of Israel. Vayakhel et ha'am, the text has it. Moses assembled the people, called them together, and asked them on God's behalf to bring forward the finest objects they possessed to help create the tabernacle so the whole people could worship God in holiness. And the people gave of the best they had, gold and silver, precious stones, materials used to create a beautiful sanctuary, one they could be proud of, one which they believed would lend itself to the perpetuation of beauty and sanctity. And then Moses invited those artisans, wise in the ways of working with beautiful items, to come forward and create a structure that embodied what God saw as appropriate for a sanctuary. In particular, Moses explained, God has called by name a man named Bezalel from the tribe of Judah, whom God filled with the Spirit of the Lord, in wisdom, understanding, knowledge, and all manner of skilled workmanship. He is filled with the wisdom of the heart, that he might teach and work with every wise-hearted person in this sacred work. When their work was complete, they had created a tabernacle that God immediately brought the divine presence into, a place of profound sacredness for our ancestors. I love that phrase for those skilled in the work of the hands, wise-hearted men and women, those who can create beauty and elegance to serve God in this world. You know, each of us has different skills. Some sing, some dance, some speak eloquently, and some of us can create works of art and practical beauty with our hands. Each of us can contribute to the creation of holiness in this world by applying those skills to holy work. And when we do, we too have the potential to bring God's presence into our midst, into our ordinary, practical world, and so make it sacred. May we each use our skills this week to make our lives and our world a little more holy. When we come back on Too Jewish, the multi-talented Rabbi Gil Marks will regale us with historical tales of Jewish foods and feasts, exciting our taste buds and awakening our minds. All this when we return on Too Jewish.
When you're looking to buy or sell your home, you probably want Tucson's best realtor on your side. That realtor is Jill Rich. As real estate values change, it's comforting to know that Jill Rich knows Tucson's real estate landscape. She follows the trends. She knows the neighborhoods. She even knows how to help you find financing. But most importantly, Jill cares. It doesn't matter if you're looking for a starter home or a castle. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. For sellers, Jill will develop a personal marketing program that'll sell your house fast. There's no one who knows Tucson real estate better. You can reach Jill Rich at Long Realty's River and Campbell office. Call 349-0174. Jill Rich, providing strong representation in a caring way. Call 349-0174. We continue with our Too Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
In the wake of the fall of President-dictator Hosni Mubarak, this week Egypt dissolved its parliament and scheduled new elections. As Israel watched its southern border nervously, the first truly democratic process in Egyptian history began. The revolution that toppled Mubarak now has the Egyptian military in control, but it looks like there will be a new and very different face to the government in the influential Arab country. Certainly the Islamists, the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt, will work to get elected, as they have already announced. What form the new parliament takes is anybody's guess, as is the durability of the 30-year peace with Israel. The Swiss government has taken measures to freeze Mubarak's assets in Swiss banks in case Egypt wants the money back to, like, you know, feed people. Some reports place Mubarak's personal wealth at $40 billion. That's with a B, but only about $4 billion is supposed to be in Switzerland, a little more than America gives Egypt in foreign aid each year. Perhaps Mubarak thoughtfully also invested in Israeli high-tech companies. Would have been a good economic choice. In other Arab capitals, revolution percolated just beneath the surface, or sometimes openly exploded. In Yemen's capital of Sana'a, protesters and government police and military clashed all week. In Libya, protests against strongman and psychopath Muammar Gaddafi increased in number and volume. And in tiny Bahrain in the Persian Gulf, protesters clashed violently with police after a couple of them were killed. It's not clear how many other Arab regimes are tottering in the same position as Egypt and Tunisia were, but Jordan clearly continues to be very worried, even after hurriedly replacing its government a couple weeks ago. Even Iran is experiencing public protest. It's also notable that many of the Palestinian demonstrators who celebrated Mubarak's downfall carried signs that read, "Abbas, you are next," referring to their own Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas of Fatah. Islamists are moving in all of these protests and revolutions, although clearly they are not the ones actually leading them. In other news, in England, an ad exhorting viewers to travel Palestine in the National Geographic magazine has been brought up before the Advertising Standards Authority for pretending that it is possible to visit the imaginary country of Palestine, which lies, and I quote from the ad, between the Mediterranean coast and the Jordan River. Well, there is a country there. It's actually called Israel. As one protester wrote, this is like saying that Portugal lies between the Mediterranean and the Atlantic Ocean and omitting Spain, or ignoring the fact that the Mediterranean coastline of quote-unquote Palestine actually is controlled by Hamas, not the Fatah-led Palestinian Authority that placed the ad. And since the same British board in April ruled that an Israeli tourism ad that showed the Kotel, the Western Wall, with the Dome of the Rock behind it, you know, the standard photo, somehow implied that the Temple Mount was under Israeli control, perish the thought, it actually is, and they forced the ad to be pulled. So we can sort of hope that this same British board will pull the ridiculous Palestinian ad. But of course, you can never be sure on such things. In our news of the absurd, a fervently ultra-Orthodox group is now certifying shops in the Jerusalem Haredi neighborhoods of Mea Shearim and Geula as kosher to assure that the clothing in those stores meets the standard of tznius, modesty, which they understand Jewish law to require. This means that rabbis will apparently supervise the clothing stores for women. According to an ad issued by the Committee for Sanctity, women who buy clothing that does not meet proper standards damage our camp's modesty. Experience shows that there's no other way to defeat this horrible breach than by having rabbis supervise the clothes' kashrut. Wow. And we thought the Muslim use of the headscarf for women was problematic. Sheesh. Oh, and the prolific Rivka, a 44-year-old Orthodox Hasidic woman from the Belzer sect in Jerusalem, last week gave birth to her 18th child. She's 44. 9 boys and 9 girls. 2 baseball teams. As she notes with a smile, "We didn't make a conscious decision to have 18 children. They came one by one, thank God." Now that's taking the biblical command to be fruitful and multiply literally. And that's the news of Jews around the world. We welcome back to Two Jewish our guest this morning, Rabbi Gil Marks, author, rabbi, food historian, Jewish historian, chef, and originally social worker and guidance counselor. Rabbi Gil Marks is a wonderful authority on all kinds of culinary subjects, but in particular on Jewish food and the Jewish connection to food. His James Beard Award-winning book, Olive Trees and Honey, Treasury of Vegetarian Recipes from Jewish Communities Around the World, is an extraordinary book. Also published the Encyclopedia of Jewish Food and the James Beard Award finalist cookbook, The World of Jewish Cooking. You edited Kosher Gourmet magazine for, 6 years or so, and then tell us a little bit about how that evolved. You were the founding editor, as I recall.
Yeah, I always liked cooking, and I always liked writing, and I put them together, and I said, well, let's do a magazine, and we ran. We did pretty well for almost 6 years, almost 7 years, until we ran into Papa Bush's non-recession, which had similar effects in that it really cut off all print advertising in the Jewish media in general. And but those are, you know, there's a beshert to these things, I've found, and it's I learned a lot, and I loved doing it, but it kind of, when the magazine went on, it allowed me to segue into these books, and now, you know, Confucius says he loves what he does, never works a day in his life, and I haven't worked in 20 years, because what I do, I just love. It's just me to sit down and to put together these little puzzles of history, and to see that the kishka is named after the stuffing and not after the intestines, and how it's connected to the biblical kutach, the Talmudic kutach, which is mentioned quite often throughout the Talmud, very interesting food, or to see how the Roman vermiculus travels through history in Jewish history to become the medieval wurmslisch, and then into frimsel and grimsel, which is noodles and fritters, and then kremslach, which is modern, you know, pancakes, like that. So it's all these little puzzles I get to put together and work on. And as you said, I have a passion. I love eating food. I love cooking food. I love understanding the chemistry of food. And I love the history of food. And I get to do all of these in my books.
So where do you think this tremendous Jewish connection with food comes from?
Well, there's several different aspects. Part of it is a ritual aspect, is that both biblically and rabbinically, many of our rituals are just intertwined with food. Whether it's on Shabbat or Yontif, the Onig Shabbat, the nature of food, whether it's matzah, which is in Chametz, which are integral to Pesach, whether it's certain traditional ones that came about, like the stuffed foods of Sukkot or the fried foods of Hanukkah, or of course with Purim coming up shortly, the poppy seeds and the filled foods and all these types of things. So they're interconnected. I mean, I was just at my great nephew's bris yesterday morning, and of course you have wine.
Mazel tov, by the way.
Thank you. Thank you. All my nephews are great, but this one is official.
And he's the youngest.
So far, but we keep adding on. There's one. There's another one due in August. So, in my books, I list the family in each book. It keeps getting bigger and bigger. It's going to be a whole page soon. So of course you have wine, and then afterwards there's the seuda. The sort of mitzvah that accompanies it.
Right? The meal, the commanded meal of enjoyment.
Yes. And where, of course, in Ashkenazim in America, we'll have bagels and egg salad and smoked fish and lox and cream cheese. And so all of this will be in the encyclopedia. Is how, you know, in Europe, a bagel never tucks lox or vice versa. That's only in America. Where that came together in the 30s, when the standard upscale Sunday morning brunch was Eggs Benedict. Well, you can't get too much more trace than Eggs Benedict, which is an English muffin with Canadian bacon and hollandaise sauce. And so even a lot of Jews who didn't keep kosher had trouble with that. So instead the Jews...
You know, it's that rare combination of pork and dairy that just kind of captures everything that's treif.
Yes, it does. But what you do is you substitute a bagel, which was not a sandwich in Europe, but it became one here. You substitute the bagel for the English muffin. You substitute lox for the bacon. And you substitute cream cheese for hollandaise sauce. And voila, you have a new classic, a Sunday morning thing. And then
since you're Eastern European, you add some red onion. And if you're fancy, you put some capers.
Oh, I love the red onion. Because I love the textural differences. I love the flavor and textural differences in food. I hate monotone foods, which either all look the same or taste the same or feel the same. If I have ice cream, I mean, I like ice cream, but I'd rather have, you know, one of the ones with some textural differences in and flavor differences in it that makes it more interesting to me.
So, obviously, we have been deeply connected with food since the beginning of our existence. You know, and you've traced this in some of your writing about all the rules in the Torah, about the specifics about what foods can and can't be eaten, and then how they're supposed to be prepared, and then the Talmudic amplifications. So this is the $64,000 or 64,000 shekel question. What are your favorite Jewish foods?
That's like asking which is your favorite kid.
Yes.
I mean, I like them all. One of the things I do not do in my book is just concentrate on Ashkenazim. There's a strong emphasis on the Sephardi and Mizrahi, the Eastern Jews, which is incredible foods. Most of those communities predate the Ashkenazic community, and their foods, some of them are quite ancient and special. So I just love them all. And I would add one more thing to your earlier question, that beyond the ritualistic aspect of food, I think food also has been a defense mechanism to Jews, sort of like this Jewish sense of humor has been. And it's one of the things that helped us to survive in a very, very oppressive sometimes diaspora. The S mine kin type of mentality of we have this, the opposite of that actually. It's part of the of our ability to survive, and food has, as with humor and other aspects of Jewish makeup, has helped to allow that. And not both physically and spiritually, because the what connects one generation of Jews to the next, particularly when we're free to choose what we want to do, is usually an emotional connection. And part of that is certainly gastronomical, whether it's bagels or a Friday night dinner or latkes or whatever. So you have these various spiritual and emotional attachments that food survives. So it's a physical and a spiritual defense mechanism as well.
Well, in the course of creating, you know, you have so many remarkable menus, so many remarkable recipes, and there's so much richness. You somehow can make something as simple as carob sound interesting and deep and diverse and connected to all of its Jewish sources. How do you do your research? Where do you look?
I look everywhere. I've been collecting information on my computer for more than 20 years since I got my first computer. So every time I find any food information, I check it out, and much of the stuff we get is wrong. The main part of the research is to see what actually exists. So say you take something like cinnamon. Now, we just assume that it's the same thing as the biblical spice cinnamon used in the temple and other things, but it's not. The name came from it, but we know from many, many different sources and ways that the modern cinnamon is in no relationship of name related to the biblical cinnamon.
So if it isn't related, so what was it?
Well, nobody totally knows. I mean, there actually is a midrash that says that once the temple was destroyed, cinnamon disappeared. Kinnaman. There's other people who've looked in and said it might be an item called Mecca straw, a spice called Mecca straw. But
we don't really know.
Nobody totally knows. We do know it's not from many, many different ways. Both the descriptions of the plant in ancient Greek and Roman sources, from many different areas. So part of what I do is look to see what as correct as I can make things, and then fortunately Google, thank God for Google, really makes my life and research easier, because I can click on and find whether, you know, when a dish sometimes could be mentioned, or find sources for it, and it's just combing through, and then I go, you can look through my library of whether it's the Talmud, Midrashim, various rabbinic sources, because see, most societies do not, their writings do not involve the food of the common person. But in Jews, it's the opposite. Because of the kosher, because of the dietary laws, the rabbinic literature is full of mentionings of food and certain dishes. So when Rashi talks about pashtida in some of his responses, in some of his letters and things, he almost gives his wife's recipe of this dish, which was a sort of a meat pie from the early medieval period that they ate on every Shabbat.
So there's a depth really throughout Jewish history to every kind of food, if you start to think about it.
Almost certainly. That's, as you were saying from the book, whether it's carob, the lowly carob, which is actually interesting because I was in Israel last year, and there were some fresh carobs on the tree, and they actually kind of much more interesting when you get them fresh off the tree rather than when they've been sitting around and dried out for 6 months, and then they become like shoe leather. There's all these little historical things that we don't know sometimes, like the fact that although the carob is not mentioned at all mysteriously in the Bible anywhere, that its seeds are because of their import. And so it kind of opens up levels of understanding and context that that they have, and then it also, it's a connecting thing too. It transcends time. I mean, foods, matzahs and carobs and biblical pomegranates or whatever, when you eat those, you connect to Jews throughout history. And so food can be a tremendous instrument in more than just nutrition or filling your stomach or survival. It's historical and emotional, and you know, whether it's a comfort food or whether it's an enlightening aspect of it.
Well, I want to thank Rabbi Gil Marks for helping connect us through food to Jews everywhere. Where's the best place for people to find your stuff?
Oh, you can get it anywhere. I mean, it's certainly, you can get it on any of the book websites.
Amazon and so on. And your own website is www.gilmarks.com.
Yeah, and then so I do that. I do blogging. My editor said you have to do all the social media. That's what it's about these days. So
that's right.
I web, I blog, I Twitter.
And you continue to eat and cook and write about it and history. Thanks so much, Rabbi Marks.
Thank you very much.
When we come back, we'll hear about next week's guest, get a final musical play out on Too Jewish.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Next week, our guest will be performer Judy Kay, actress, singer. She has performed in every show with all of the most famous actors, from John Travolta to Barry Boswick to Theodore Bikel. She's in the upcoming show here in Tucson, the wonderful Lost in Yonkers, and she'll be with us. Our play out this morning is to keep you with a positive mental attitude. It's from Safam, and it's called just that. My friends, have a Shavuot Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.
Avram planned a nice vacation, took his boy to mountain climb. Wife thought it would give them both a chance to have some quality time. Isaac volunteered to carry the knife, the rope, and the firewood. That's a man with confidence and a positive mental attitude.
It's all right now.
Looking at the way we live.
All right.
I don't should be so negative.
It's all right now.
Always look for what is good.
It's all right.
With a positive mental attitude. Israelites were in the desert. Soon they started to complain. Reminisce about the old days. Water, give them food. Stop the clutching with the use of a positive mental attitude.
It's all right now.
Looking at the way we live.
All right.
I don't should be so negative.
It's all right now.
Always look for what is good.
It's all right.
With a positive mental attitude. You don't need no marijuana to impress your loser friends. You don't need the latest fashion or drive a Mercedes Benz. See the cup, is it half empty? No, the cup, it is half full. You can always be a winner with a positive mental attitude.
The preceding program was produced and paid for by Temple Emmanuel.